Okay, we are in Mamar Sheni, Ois Samach Vav, 66. We are continuing in the discussion. We keep having big fundamental tangents, but the general discussion we're getting back to now is the sage showing to the king of Kuza that since Judaism really is the manifestation of the divine, it involves perfection in all areas. It involves having all areas of wisdom developed. It involves intellectualism on all areas. And therefore he showed, for example, how the Chachamim of our nation were involved with all of the different Chachmas. They had to be, the Torah drew on all of the different Chachmas, demanded proficiency in all the different Chachmas. And the last discussion was how the Torah also drew very, very much on music, demanded that music also be a very well-developed field in the Jewish nation, although it is not that way today. So now we move on to show other manifestations of this.
Could it be then that, let's say, for example, there's a place in New York called the Living Torah Museum. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. But it's basically a place where, from a guy, and he wanted to show kids what, you know, it talks about a Sula in the Mishnah, or, you know, it talks about a Nesher, what does it look like?
Okay.
So according to this, that seems to be very important. Meaning,
I don't know.
Let me develop that, I'm developing it.
Alright, well, we'll move on meanwhile, but get back to me. Okay. Now take it further. If you want to really see where intellectualism was developed, look at Shlomo. Look at what was going on in his time. This was a man. Now, what does he want here? He's going to move on to do is to show how Shlomo was one of the greatest intellects, intellectuals ever, and to show the greatness of the wisdom that he achieved. Now what does he want? I mean, if he wants to show that the Jews as a in general were a very great nation, how does one individual show that? No, what he actually wants to do is to show how the divinity shone through the Jewish people. That's why their excellence in all these different areas was actually because of the divinity shining through them. And this is what he's using Shlomo HaMelech as, an example of where you see how the divinity shone through and brought him to the greatest level of intellectualism that a person could reach. He was proficient. He addressed all areas of chachmas based on divine koyach, as well as perfectly developed intellect. First of all, in and of itself, he was a brilliant man. And therefore, as he's going to show later, he was the greatest of philosophers, the greatest of thinkers, the greatest of intellect. And in addition, he says, because of his kedusha, because of the great madrega he was on, he was guided by Ruach HaKodesh to reach the ultimate truth and to reach the ultimate understanding. And therefore, when it says in the Pesukim, right, they cite down here that he actually developed all areas of the natural world. Right? It says Vayedaber, where's the Pesuk they cite here? Pesuk that describes how Vayedaber Shlomo, how he spoke of all the trees and all the birds, etc., etc., etc. How he described the simple understanding of the pasuk is all these natural phenomena all the way. And from all around, the wise people of the world were coming to draw on his knowledge and to introduce it to their nations. And now he says something very interesting. He makes a a bold claim, a bold assertion. He says, actually, all of the great philosophy, all the great intellectualism that we see subsequently in the nations was all really drawn from us.
From
Shlomo. Yeah, from Shlomo. Tchila. Because, so this is pointed out that God who points this out, the Maharal, perhaps the Maharal, that you look, what do you think of philosophy? You think of the Greeks. You think of the Greeks. It's not like the Greeks. I think it was the Khuzari who actually pointed this out earlier in the Sefer, the Khuzari. It's not like the Greeks were a nation of philosophers from time beginning. There was a very specific period in which there was an explosion of intellectualism, and then it passed. So he says that actually, don't think that they originated it. Look at the historic context. He says, we know that Shlomo HaMelech filled the world with immense wisdom, which means that this wisdom was prevalent primarily among the Jews. The Jews were the epitome of intellectualism in the world. When we were conquered by the Babylonians, so they took a lot of it and they integrated it into their systems as though it was their chachma. V'achakach el Paras Umodai, and it moved from there onto Persia and Media. V'achakach el Yavan, and afterward to the Greeks. V'achakach el Roimi, and then to the Romans. It's really our chachma changing shape and form, metamorphosing in different ways, manifesting one time in a Greek way, one time in a Roman way, and changing hands and changing form. And it's broken. What's that?
The people who are originated music, weapons, you know, from these people, they obviously were not Jewish.
Okay. So we're talking about Chachma now.
So am I.
What?
This Chachma, this music is one of the Chachmas.
Yeah.
So it was Tuval Kain or whoever that invented music. He wasn't Jewish.
I invent music. You're getting into a philosophical question. Was music invented by man, or is it an inherent Chachma? If it's an inherent chachma, it means that he was the first one who really started developing it. But that doesn't mean that he was the master of it. Could have been developed much more than him in later times. And he's saying that, yes, the Jews developed music much further than it was at that point. And even more than that, we saw last week, that music, there was actually music that was brought down from Moshe, by Moshe from Har Sinai. So yes, if he was the first one who started making a big deal out of music, fine. There were also people who started making a big deal out of chachma. But when the Jews actually got the Torah, when the divine spirit started throbbing within the Jews, they became the ultimate of all these areas.
But were they the original?
Not necessarily. Why would they need to be? They weren't the original people in the world. They don't have to be the inventors. What we're showing is that these people brought these areas of intellectualism to their maximum. And he's saying that what you see today, the philosophy that you see pervading mankind today actually draws its roots from the Jewish people. So now, ובערך הזמן, ברוב המצויים, and with all the time we went by, and with all the hands that it changed, people already don't identify these chachmas as Jewish chachmas. They are attributed to the Greeks and to the Romans. While he's claiming that actually where it all originated from was chachmas shleima that changed hands. On the one hand, the Jews went to Galus, which very much affected much of the Chachma that they had, a lot, like we saw with music and with other areas of Chachma. Once the Jews were in Galus, they lost a lot of the capacity and the richness that they had had when they were well settled on their land. While at the same time, this very Chachma started flourishing among the conquerors, to the extent that it actually looked like they had the upper hand in philosophy, while actually, really, it's just stolen from us and redressed. So down here, he gives some historic background on some of these things. In the Kol Yehuda, he cites all different kinds of svarim which show how the earlier philosophers were busy with different Jewish figures. Among them, he cites, I don't know what these different books are, but how Aristotle, who was the Rebbe of Alexander, as the Mefarshim here say, the truth is that was a big part of how Aristotle got his wide acclaim. He might have been known as the originator of so much Chachma, but the truth is, really, as the Rebbe of Alexander, he had the perfect forum to have the Chachma, the Lamaisa he was selling, to have it spread to all corners of the earth. But actually, he wasn't necessarily the one who thought up all these things. Now, I want to make it clear, we're not undermining, we're not doubting the immensity of his intellect. That's not subject to question. What we're saying is, was it really all original? Or maybe much of his Chachma was actually drawn from other sources. So he brings different sources, and I don't even know what these sources are exactly, where they found letters from Aristotle in which he discusses things that areas of philosophy that he discussed with Shimon HaTzadik and debates that he had with him and how impressed he was with Shimon HaTzadik's Chachma.
These are found from notes made by Aristotle.
Yeah. Books by Hari and Ibsibio. I don't know. What's that? So I don't know if you would say a Talmud, but he was influenced by Shimon HaTzadik. He was influenced by Shimon HaTzadik. So I don't know. You can check out the Mefarshim here afterwards if you're interested in the background. I don't even know what these books are. Ibsibio, Apioni, Cliarvo. I don't know. Whatever it is, he cites a bunch of different earlier philosophical sources showing how much of it was influenced by discussions with different Jewish figures. Okay. Now, we have to note that there's an important underlying point here. Forgetting about the actual historic issue of is that where Aristotle got his Chachma from or not, we have to realize that at the end of the day, as it's going to be coming through here more clearly, as we saw with music, etc., the Chachma that we have today as the Jewish nation is a very diluted level of the Chachma that they had then. One simple manifestation, back in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, Shlaima's time certainly, but even in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, one simple manifestation of that, and that the Rambam discusses in Maariv HaMukhim at length, is the fact that today we have Sfarim. Today we have Sfarim was a direct consequence of the fact that as we were plunged into the Galus and things started spiraling downwards, they saw how all of the Chachma is simply being scattered in all directions, being lost, confused, distorted, because in the Galus we already didn't have the settled state of mind with all of the travails of the Galus and they're moving from place to place, etc. Tyro was starting to become hazy, etc., until they realized that it's an emergency situation. Tyro has to be committed to writing. But up until that point, it was sacrilegious to commit Tyro to writing. Tyro was meant to be preserved in the oral form. Tyro Shebiksav was written down, Tyro Shebal Peh was not. And if we want to have an idea of what Tyro Shebal Peh would have looked like had they not committed it to writing, the Rambam basically says, well, look at the secrets of the Torah. Look at the fate of what we call today Kabbalah, which was not committed to writing at that time. It was not committed to writing at that time. And basically, it boiled down to a more and more and more select few until, for all practical purposes, it almost completely fizzled out. Until there was a certain rebirth.
With the Arir.
What's that?
Even with the Arir, even earlier.
Well, different stages. With the appearance of the Zohar, which was approximately at the time of the Rashba, or maybe a little bit later.
Ramban, maybe?
What's that? The Ramban was before the appearance of the Zohar. The Ramban was still at the time when it was a very, very narrow line of tradition. The appearance of the Zohar was a certain upsurge of Kabbalah.
You mean like it was lost and they found it somewhere?
I don't know exactly how it developed, but yeah, basically. And then later with the Arizal, who caused Mamish a relative explosion of Kabbalah. And that's the Kabbalah that we have today. But other than that, it was basically a Chachma that, by and large, went lost. It needed to be that way because it was not a Chachma that could be committed to writing and just available to the public the way Talmud Bavli is. And even the Gemara, and the Mishnah that we have, it's very b'dieved that it's like that. It wasn't meant to be that way. And this is a big manifestation of the big drop in the level of intellectual capacity that our nation had in earlier times. That's why, for example, the way Yirmiyahu HaNavi expresses it in Megillas Eicha is Malka v'soreha bagoyim ein taira. Once the king and the officers of the Jewish people were lost among the nations, the Jewish people lost their taira. That's the way Chazal put it. That's why the pasuk puts it, but Chazal explained the pasuk in this way. We don't have taira anymore today. We're talking about the taira of the Chazanish, of the Chofetz Chaim, of the Vilna Gaon, right? Of the Kivei Eger, of the Rishonim, of the Amoraim, of the Tanaim. From the perspective of the people in those days, Yirmiyahu, looking at the taira of the Tanaim and the Amoraim and the Rishonim, he says, that's not taira. So, this is true, he's saying, not just for taira, which we see, but it's true for the other areas of Chachma as well. To the extent that even today we do see that at the end of the day the Jewish people are from the most intellectual nations, that is very, very small in comparison to the Chachma that was flourishing, for example, in the time of Shlomo HaMelech. The point that he's trying to bring out here with all this is to realize that you see that the Jewish people always were, or at that time were, and still today to an extent are, the most developed in all areas of Chachma, because the Torah demands being proficient in all areas of Chachma. The Torah draws on all areas of Chachma, because as the manifestation of the divine, the nature of it is going to be that yes, the divinity is going to come out in all different areas of Chachma, all different areas of human achievement.
So does the Torah demand it demands that we are proficient in this, but most of the Jews today aren't Torah observant, yet they're still very proficient in Chachmas, despite...
At the end of the day, the people are an intellectual bunch. That's not going to change. But he's saying that specifically, this manifests also the fact that the Torah actually demands it. You can't have the Torah functioning in Klal Yisrael without a very high level of intellectualism. What's that? Presumably, but that's not the discussion here. Well, as we discussed the other time, still today you will see the impressive sight of those who are. But I don't know if that's a fundamental element of our time today. I mean, I don't know if it necessarily has to be that way. The truth is that today, we, like we said, capacity has very, very, very much shrunk. Just like the Chachamim today are not what the Chachamim were, even in Tyra at that time, it's true. This is the point that we're making. The Gilgulim of the Galus caused us, our capacity to shrink more and more and more, and we can't contain the same things that we were able to contain earlier. Yet at the end of the day, you still do see that the most impressive manifestations of Chachma are among the Jewish people, even in their compromised state. Okay, and now, kind of without warning, he shifts into another discussion as well. He says another one of the reasons that the philosophy got so transformed and diluted when it changed hands so many times was also because of the fact that it was spilled out of Lashon Kodesh. It was moved from Lashon Kodesh to other languages. And this automatically is going to compromise its level because of the great advantage that Lashon Kodesh contains. And because of the capability, the potential that it has to express things and to define things just so, that can't be done in other languages. So now, characteristic of this sefer, he's already brought us into another discussion. He started by saying that actually the Chachma that we see so widespread in the world has its origins among the Jewish people. And now, he kind of parenthetically said, part of the fact that changed it so much was that it went from Lashon Kodesh into other languages. And in doing so, he noted, because Lashon Kodesh is really the greatest of languages in terms of the language itself and in terms of how you can express things. And here's where the Kuzari is going to ask his next question. Amar HaKuzari, and here we get into a new discussion. Lashon Kodesh. Hayesh le'ivris ma'la Lashon Ha'arav. Oh, so you're very basically telling him, saying, you are crediting yourself with everything. Now you move on to the next thing, also with language. You're continuing with this chauvinistic Jewish approach. And in every last area, we've got to be the best. And now you've just said, also, you know, once you're going to take Chachma from Lashon Kodesh to other languages, it's inevitably going to compromise it, because Lashon Kodesh is the ultimate of languages, it's the greatest of languages, it's the best for expressing things, etc. So the Kuzari says, is that so? Hayeshli Ivris Mala Lashon Ha'arav? Does Hebrew, Lashon Kodesh, have an advantage over Arabic? He Yoser Shlemo Chava Mimenu. Arabic is much more of a developed and comprehensive language than Hebrew is. This can't be denied. We know language. We know Lashon Kodesh. We know Arabic. Arabic is a much richer language. It's got much more words. Yes, the vocabulary is much bigger, which also gives it much more opportunity for expression, etc. Rich expression, defining things just so. Whereas Lashon Kodesh is a much more limited vocabulary. So here the sage says another important point to be aware of, just again in terms of understanding where we stand relative to what Judaism used to be. The Jewish language, Lashon HaKodesh, has met with the same fate as its bearers did. Meaning, Lashon Kodesh suffered in the same way as the Jewish people did. Just like the Jewish people dropped from their glorious state to state of the downtrodden underdog, Lashon Kodesh met the same fate. It also dropped from its glorious state as they dropped. And that's why today the Lashon Kodesh that we know is a very compromised form of Lashon Kodesh. Lashon Kodesh is in fact a much richer language with a lot more potential than we're aware of. We don't know Lashon Kodesh, in other words. We don't know Lashon Kodesh.
I heard one professor tell me that they estimate that of the Hebrew that we have from Tanakh time, only about a third of it is still around today.
Only about a third of it. Oh, therefore, you just want a simple example of this. You think you know Lashon Kodesh? You open up a Sefer Bereishis, you fare fine. Open up Sefer Iyev and see if you know Lashon Kodesh. Right? You open up Sefer Iyev was written in Lashon Kodesh, right? You can't make out the beginning of the pasuk with the end of the pasuk. You open up, it's probably the hardest Sefer in Tanakh to learn. But not just Sefer Iyev. Open up Sefer Tehillim. Right? You have a lot of the prakim, the prakim that we say in shul, usually the prakim that are easier to understand, right? But start flipping through Sefer Tehillim, you don't understand what's going on, how one word connects to the next, all kinds of strange words that we don't even know what they mean, right? And plenty of other Sfarim also in the Nevi'im. You have some Nevi'im that are easier than others, but there are Yeshaya, you have expositions that you just don't know what's going on. There were all kinds of ways of using Lashon Kodesh that go much beyond. It's like someone said to me that you have to understand that word is a lot more than a sophisticated word processor. Right? That basically means a word you type. You have to appreciate the power of word. There's so much more you can do with it. This is a guy who was nudging me for a while to hire him to teach me how to use word. I appreciated the idea, I just never had the time for it. Whatever it is, the point is, yes, you can have a very, very well-developed and sophisticated program, while what it is for me is basically, like you said, a sophisticated word processor. You can type documents and save them, and that's great. You can even make changes. It's not like a typewriter where it's on the page, right? There's so much more to it. So you have to realize, we're using Lashon Kodesh Mamish as that. We're using it like as a word processor, in a very basic form. We have a very general understanding of Lashon Kodesh. We know some of the vocabulary, and we use that. While we are detached from the full richness of the language, from all of the different nuances and from the way it can be used to express things.
It doesn't seem to answer the Kuzari's question, because it seems that Hebrew language fell, but the Arab language didn't seem to, but the Arab language didn't fall?
No. See, the Arab language, they have it in its full form. We don't have the Hebrew language in its full form. We don't have the full Hebrew language. We have a very limited part of the Hebrew language. And we have a very limited part of the rules and of the way it works. the Hibat, so we're going to be focusing on this for a while now. There's a lot of significance here. The Ba'atzma, this is important in understanding a lot of things. One area, this is just a pet peeve of mine, so I'm just going to use this opportunity to bring it home. In the whole discussion of Pshutoi Shel Mikra. Right? Pshutoi Shel Mikra. Take Tanakh at face value. Right? Now, Chazal say Ein Mikra Yitzimidei Pshuta. Chazal do say that, right? Ein Mikra Yitzimidei Pshuta. But you have to know the language. Right? If you want to be able to tell me what Pshutoi Shel Mikra means, you have to be able to explain to me comfortably how to read a full parak in Sefer Iyov. Right? Otherwise, you don't know Lashon Kodesh. What are you telling me what Pshutoi Shel Mikra is? You know what expressed what? How they expressed different things? So because you know some of the words, you don't know the other words, now you consider yourself a whole authority and being able to explain Pshutoi Shel Mikra. You know Pshutoi Shel Mikra, if you can explain to me the complicated prakim of Iyov, then you know Lashon Kodesh.
Why can't you know it for Dvarim Benadiyah?
What's that?
Why can't you know it for Dvarim
Benadiyah? Oh, so you could. You can make sense of the basic words, but you see, once you see that there's a lot more to the language, you understand that there's also all kinds of ways the language was used that you might not be at all familiar with. I'll give you a simple example. So let's say somebody is going to come in 1,000 years from now and read a book that somebody wrote today. Okay? There's inflections. And then, let's say everything's going to be different. All the forms of expression, but the language will be the same, basically. Okay? And he's going to read. One person set another person up, really did something terrible to him. And the victim says to the offender, "Thank you very much." Okay? He'll be puzzled. Why is he thanking him? Why is he thanking him? At that time in history, there isn't going to be such a concept as sarcasm anymore. Okay? Why is he thanking him? Someone will come and explain that there's a masaira that it actually means the opposite. There's a tradition that it actually means the opposite. When he said thank you, he really meant what we call sarcasm. So he said, okay, that's a pshat, that's a drash, but it's not the Pshutoi Shel Mikra. Pshutoi Shel Mikra is that he's thanking him. Well, I mean, if you don't know how the language was used, don't consider yourself an authority on the language. You have to go back to that time and know how the language was used, right? So, therefore, you have to realize, it's important to realize that not only don't we have concepts of the mentality, the mindset of those times, we don't even have concept of the language. So now, what's that? I don't think so. You have to get back into that time. The Chachamim throughout the generations have put a lot of work into developing it. The Kuzari is among them. But he's saying that at the end of the day, since all we have is remnants, we have artifacts that are left, you can't really go build a whole... You can try to put together a picture, but you can't really rebuild the whole thing based on just a few pieces that we have left today. And that's what he's saying. The way the Mefarshim put it is, what we have of Lashon Kodesh is what happens to be in Tanakh. What we don't have it is a live language that's still being used in the way it was then. So we try to rebuild it based on the Tanakh that we have. We're working backwards. But actually, there may have been a lot of words that happened not to make it in Tanakh, because they didn't need to make it into Tanakh. There could be all kinds of usages and things like that that aren't in Tanakh. So it's like, you're trying to reconstruct the English language. You happen to have a set of books. Whatever you have in that books, in those books, that's all you're going to have. You're going to try to put together, work backwards, and put together rules of grammar, etc., based on the usage you see of those books. But you only have a limited extent of what's actually going on. That's how the Mefarshim here put it. So, the Hiba Atzma, while Lashon Kodesh itself is Hachashuva Shebelashonis, the greatest of languages, Mikabala Usvara. This is so by tradition, and it's also so logically, as we'll explain. Hakabala, we know this by tradition because this is the tongue in which Hashem spoke with Adam and Chava, which means that this is the ultimate tongue. You might ask, why does Hashem have to speak in the ultimate tongue? Who said there is an ultimate tongue? Right? But the truth that we have to understand is there's a little more to this discussion. And this is really what he's getting at. We're going to be developing this over the next couple of weeks. It's more than that. It's just the best of all the different languages in terms of languages. Russian Kurdish is actually a live language. Meaning, all languages are what? You have this here. You want to convey to somebody what you're talking about, so you come up with a word. The Anglos call it a table. But is there any inherent connection between T-A-B-L-E and this thing here? There's no connection. It's completely arbitrary. Language is arbitrary, right?
Convention.
Yeah, it's convention. It's convention. We have to say something. So instead of calling this a chair and this a table, we call this a table and this a chair. It could have been the other way around also. It wouldn't have been a problem. Right? Now, if you put the gematria of table together, it's not going to bring you any closer to understanding what a table is. Right? With Lashon Kodesh, it's not like that. With Lashon Kodesh, each letter has its own nature, has its own reality. And the combinations of letters to form a word have an inherent connection to what that word is. And also more than that, the whole concept of gematria is a live concept, which means that gematria, the way gematria today is used, it's used almost like a gimmick. A person who's good at gematrias gets up and says that kol sasim, when he speaks at Sheva Brachas, kol sasim, kol simcha, kol chasim, kol kala, is the same gematria as the name of the chasim and kala put together plus the shvigur's name. Okay, so that's, then in gematria today we know as gimmicks, as vertlach, not as a serious form of chachma, not as a serious form of Yiddishkeit. We have to realize that actually, on the deeper level, in Kabbalah, let's say, gematria holds a lot of significance in connecting different words to each other and understanding the true essence of different words. I'll give one example of this. I'll have to see if I remember this well. But I'll give one example of this. Bereshis Bara Elokimus HaShemayim V'Sa'aretz. You know what? I'm not going to ruin this by saying it without remembering it right. This is too good to ruin. I'll save it for next week. I'm going to look it up again. But we'll see how the koyach, how what Lashon Kodesh actually contains. But that's right. He's about to say that. Let's see. This was the language that Hashem spoke with Adam and Chava. And they both spoke this language. As you'll see, meaning you might say, you might argue, who said they spoke Lashon Kodesh? Maybe the Torah was written in Lashon Kodesh, because that's what the Jews spoke at the time. That was their language. But maybe it's actually just recounting things that happened in different languages. He says, no, you see that Adame Adama, you see that from the names that it was actually based on true Lashon Kodesh. Adam was from the word Adama. Isha Me'ish. Chava Me'chai. Cain is from Kanisi. Sheis is from the word Shos. Noach is from Yinachameinu. Im Eidus HaTorah the Kabbalah's dor achar dor ad ever ad noyach ad odom. Because we see the Torah testifying this, and also we see that this was the language that we can trace back. We know that the Torah started in Lashon Kodesh, and you can trace it back to ever, to noyach, to odom. The shehi hoy saloshen ever ubavuroi nikreis ivris. Hebrew was the language used by ever. That's why it's called Ivrit. You ever wondered why Ivrit is called Ivrit? It's called Ivrit because it was the language of Aver. Why Aver? Why shouldn't it be called Odomis? It was used by Odom too. Or Noyachis. So he says, Ivrit, Lashon Kodesh is identified with Aver for the following reason. This is what you were saying. At the time of the Tower of Babel, when people were dispersed and all the languages were spread all over the place, the language of Lashon Kodesh remained, which was the original language, remained with Aver. He was the one who retained Lashon Kodesh. Lashon Kodesh was one of the 70 languages. He was the one who lamaisit stayed with. And therefore, it came to be identified with him. It was the language of Aver. From that point on, until then, it was the universal language. From that point on, it was the language of Aver, and therefore it was called Ivris.
How did the other languages, if everyone spoke Hebrew, how did the other languages develop?
That was the nace of the Tower of Babel.
But my understanding was there are opinions that said that Hebrew was the international language, but everyone had, each of the 70 nations had their own language, and afterwards Hashem just made them forget the Hebrew, but each of them had their own languages to begin with.
Possibly. I don't know. That already, I don't know.
Why are we saying that Hebrew was one of the seven? Because Yosef, Harav knew all seven, but Yosef was 71.
Oh, if it was 70 or 75, what, I wasn't calculating that. Maybe it was 71. I don't know. Now, Ukvar Hoya Avram Medaber Baram is Bilkazdim. He says something interesting. You should know that Avram himself, his native tongue was not Hebrew. He wasn't born in that area. He was born in Ur Kazdim. He spoke Aramaic. Sha'aram is he Loshen Kazdim. Aramaic was the language of the Babylonians where Avram Avinu was born. Vaisalaya Ivris Loshen Miuchedes Loshen HaKodesh. He used Hebrew. This might be what you were alluding at. He used Hebrew. He had it. Either he had it by tradition, or he connected to the tradition when he went to learn by Shem Be'ever. He used Hebrew. But he kept it only for discussions of Kodesh. V'aram is Lashon Chol. For mundane things, Avraham Avinu spoke Aramaic. Interesting point. Now here also, he's bringing home an important point here. Today, we use Hebrew as a mundane language. He's saying that at that time, Avraham Avinu would consider that sacrilegious. Lashon HaKodesh was used for Kodesh, and for Kodesh only, because of the greatness of the language. He held it in reverence. He didn't use it to say, pass the salt.
Let's say during the time of the first base of Mikdash, did people converse each other for mundane matters or business in Hebrew?
So you know what? I'm not sure. It could be that, yeah, it could be that not. In script, for example, they definitely used a different script. Aleph Beis was used only for Kodesh, and they had a different script. What language they actually spoke based on this? I don't know.
Did Abraham come after the Tower of Babel?
Yeah.
But during the Tower?
What's that?
Wasn't he more like during the Tower? Wasn't he around? He was alive then?
I don't remember the... Around or somewhat after. V'cheinosa oisa Yishmael el ha'arav. Yishmael also carried Hebrew over to Arabia. And they developed three languages which were very similar and had a lot in common: Aramis va'Aravis va'Ivris, Aramaic and Arabic and Hebrew, in terms of vocabulary and in terms of usage, in terms of the way you used it to express things, grammar, etc. These three languages are very similar. However, but Lashon Kodesh was the greatest among them. And he says that it must be so, logically. Because if this was used by the nation who were living the ultimate purpose on earth, who were performing the greatest functions on earth, if they were using this language, and these are the ones who had to be living the word of Hashem, to whom the Nevi'im had to convey the word of Hashem, there's no question that this had to be done in the most perfect way possible, and therefore the most perfect language possible is going to be used. What's that? Sefer Daniel is Aramaic, pure Aramaic.
What does pure Aramaic mean? Isn't that...
Look, okay, you'll see it's much harder than Gemara. Gemara is Yeshivish Aramaic. It's a mixture of Hebrew and Aramaic.
But why would it be? Why was it not? It was Nebuah. So why was it not?
There were certain visions there. I don't know. Perhaps it's an indication that they actually did speak Aramaic at the time. Perhaps. I don't know. But I don't know. I don't know why that was in Aramaic more than other things. So, once again, the word of Hashem has to be conveyed in the most perfect way possible, in the most ultimate way possible. And therefore, if this was the language being used to convey nevuas, v'atzorech la'azhara v'laniguni, and you had to use this to convey the instruction of the Torah, You have to instruct people. It had to be as clear as possible and as exact as possible. Once again, they had to use the most perfect language in order to be able to define it just so. Also, anigunim v'azmirois. It also had to be used for the song in the Beis HaMikdash. If there would have been other languages that would be better candidates for more perfect songs, there's no question that they would have been used for the song in the Beis HaMikdash. If this was the language used for the song in the Beis HaMikdash, which had to be the ultimate in music and song, obviously Hebrew is most suited for that. Umalcheim Moshe v'Yeshua v'David v'Shleima. We have leaders like Moshe and Yeshua, David and Shlomo, Moshe and Yeshua, who are busy constantly conveying directly the word of Hashem. And David and Shlomo, who are busy instructing the people. Could it be that they might find themselves at a loss for how to express what they're trying to express? No, it must be that this language that they used provided all opportunity, all possibilities. Anything you needed to achieve in a language, anything you needed to convey in a language, you could do through Lashon Kodesh.
I don't understand the proof there from David and Shlomo. I can understand from a Masorah, but how could he say that it's from Svara?
No, he's saying from Svara, the fact that Hashem set it up such that these people are conveying the divine word, it must be that Hashem would have them use the language which is most apt for conveying it accurately, perfectly, in the best way possible.
In other words, it was unlike today. It was possible to express your fullest feelings, describe something in the
Hebrew
in Hebrew that we can't do today.
Exactly, Hebrew was able to be used. You were able to maximize whatever it is you were trying to convey. As we saw earlier, what's that?
It's usually not the best of proofs, because it was, therefore it must have been, and therefore it's the best. Like,
no. You're asking what's the premise here? It's kind of like saying, right? That's the famous raya. How do we know that Yaakov wore a strangle?
All the kizbuts.
It says Vayetze Yaakov. Yaakov went out. Would he have gone out without a strangle? Right. So, therefore, it must be that he wore a strangle. So, okay. So you're asking, where does it begin? No, it begins as follows. We have already established the premise that the divine word was prevalent in Klal, right? So that's not what he's coming to say now. He's going to say now, after we've already established that Klal Yisrael were living the divine, right? That they were living the divine word, right? That Hashem was connected with them. If the function of Klal Yisrael is to be learning the word of Hashem, and for its leaders to be conveying the word of Hashem, it must be that Hashem would provide them with the language that's most apt for them. And therefore, he's saying that if we find that the language they were provided with is Lashon Kodesh, it must be that Hashem deemed this the best language for this purpose. That's his raya here. He's not proving the divinity of the Jewish people from the fact that they used Lashon Kodesh, and that Lashon Kodesh must have been the divine language because the Jewish people used it. No, divinity of the Jewish people has already been established. His only agenda here is to bring Lashon Kodesh onto that bandwagon. So he's saying, how do we get Lashon Kodesh onto that bandwagon? If language is a fundamental part of conveying all of those divine messages, it must be that the best language was used. So now, Hayitochen sheyechsalei melitza, could it be that they would be missing the means to express themselves? Beis sheyutzuchim elem, when they needed to convey something. The same way we find that when we want to express things in Hebrew, we might have a hard time because we can't find exactly the right way to say it. It can't be that they were in such a state. It can't be that Hashem would set them up in such a state. Haraisa, look, when it came to the Mishkan, Sipurat Torah, HaMishkan, HaEifoy, VaChoshem VeZulasam, when the Torah had to give all the intricate details there, the Torah had all the words it needed for those particular gemstones. So now, there are, I don't know how many other kinds of gemstones that we don't know the Hebrew words for. Why don't we know the Hebrew words for? Because the Torah never mentioned them. But it can't be that it just happened to be that Lashon Kodesh had the words for these 12 stones. And I don't know how many gemstones are there. Would I be safe in saying that there's at least another 50? I don't know. But much more. Okay. So it doesn't make sense that exactly these 12 stones the Torah had the words for, but for the other 50 plus, there just happened not to be words for. No, obviously the Torah had the word for every last gemstone, and therefore it had the words for these 12. Why don't we know the names of the other plenty of gemstones? Simply because the Torah never had need to mention it, so we don't know what the Hebrew word for it was. But at that time, people who wanted to refer to it were able to do so. That's right, that's right. So, when it needed these far out names to describe particular types of fabrics, garments, stones, for the Torah's purposes, there are all the words it needed. So obviously Lashon HaKodesh contained this. If it contained this, presumably it contained a lot more too. The Kamanoa Seder HaSipurahu. And you see how perfectly it's put down, concisely, with the perfect words for everything. The Chen Shmoy Sa'amim, Umeneo Oifois Va'avanim. The same goes for all the different nations. The Torah had names for them all. Also look at the Torah's list of birds. Once again, all the birds that it needed to state, it had names for. All the different insects that the Torah had no reason to state, we're going to assume that there weren't names for. The Zmiris David, look how rich in language the Zmiris and David are. Oh, these are the examples that we gave before. Look also how rich and how much more they use Lashon Kodesh in Eov's debate with his friends. Look also at the rich style of Yeshaya, but none of us can speak that way today because we simply don't know how to use the language. None of us can go express ourselves the way Eov did, the way Yeshaya did. Vizulasam, etc. Okay? We'll continue next week, Bez Hashem. I hope to bring home some of the points we were making here and more practical down to those words. We know that.